Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast with news and opinion from the absurd political reality, which is our home. My name is John.
And my name is Adam.
Today, we look at the EU's plans to attack the rise of authoritarianism among its own member states. We examine the aftermath of the Korean Peninsula Summit, and Adam reports on the complexities of the Irish border and its effects on the Brexit negotiations. But first, Adam, how are you?
I'm not bad. But there's this great story from Australia that's kind of been keeping me a little bit more upbeat. Emmanuel Macron called the Australian Prime Minister's wife delicious. I don't know if you heard this. It's a mistranslation. He used as he was speaking English, he seemed to mistranslate the French word délicieuse, which is delightful. So it was something along the lines of, thank you to you, Prime Minister, and your delicious wife.
Oh, man, well, I think Trump's rubbing off on him.
Well, the Prime Minister's wife anyway said that she was flattered, so there you go.
Oh, lovely. All right, so EU plans. What do we got?
Right, so fascinating stuff coming out of the European Union this week. It is budget time. I know, it's just riveting stuff. This is the European Commission. This is the executive branch of the EU. And every 6 years or so, they propose what's called a multi-annual financial framework. It's essentially a big European budget for 6 odd years. This one's supposed to run from 2021 to 2027. This is actually a really interesting thing because included in it is an attempt by the EU to give itself taxation powers. Governments have always been hesitant to give the EU any of the taxation powers. So here's what we're going to do. The budget in particular has an odd little side measurement to it that I want to discuss with you, John.
Okay.
But I'll give a brief rundown of what the budget actually is, because it in itself is quite interesting. So it's a budget, remember, over 6 years of 1.279 trillion euros. That's a lot. It's 1.114 of the bloc's gross national income, which actually surpasses a previous cap of 1%. What they're trying to do is increase the size of the budget, even though the UK is leaving.
Hmm. Right? Okay.
The UK contributes 13 billion to the EU coffers. And so they're going to be taking that out, but they also want to increase their spending. So this doesn't go down well with a lot of the more financially conservative members of the European Union. The South is expected to get extra money to spend on borders because of increased migration. There's going to be increased spending on research and, in particular, pharmaceuticals, but farmers will see their subsidies go down.
Hmm.
The budget itself tends to benefit the poorer nations, so the biggest beneficiaries are going to be Poland, Romania, Greece, and Hungary. And now that's important for the little side measure that we're going to be discussing later. The budget must be agreed by the European Council in a unanimous vote, and this is essentially the governing body of the EU. This is all the heads of states of the, well, soon to be 27 EU members. But that will be difficult to do in its current form. The wealthy northerners, for example, don't really like the idea of subsidising the south and the east. Austria, in particular, which has a particularly right-wing government nowadays, is running the line of small government is best government. They are one of the strictest financially conservative governments in the EU at the moment. And in the East, there's increasing criticism that the budget is designed to punish them for backsliding away from democracy. So here's where it gets interesting. Along with the budget, there's another financial plan that's been proposed. The EU itself has little executive power to perform or to execute its own directives. It's reliant on the governments of the member states to implement its policy. One of the few means that it can actually pull some legitimate strings is through the power of the purse. They do have the ability to create financial measures that would withhold funding to member states. So this new measure is designed to withhold funding from member states in which there is, quote, a deficiency of the rule of law or of a problem of financial management. Now, this is clearly targeted at Poland and Hungary. Poland has made moves to change its constitution, putting the judicial system under the control of the government, and Hungary's President Orban has championed illiberal democracy or majoritarianism. And he's also taken steps to censor the media and shut down a university which has been critical to his regime.
I remember that story, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Central European University, which is still open, by the way, after mass protests.
Right.
People came out onto the streets and kept open. The problem with that, though, is that it's supported by Soros, who is a thorn in the side of Orban.
And many conservatives in the United States as well.
And hence the complexities of dealing with a man like Orban. He actually does have allies in greater powers. The measure couldn't be included in the budget itself because of that unanimous vote that's needed to pass the budget. So as a financial measure, it actually only needs a qualified majority in the European Council, which means at least 55% of EU members that contain 65% of the population of the entire EU. So it's doable, even if Poland and Hungary vote against it, which they would be likely to do, it still looks as if it will pass because you would have particularly wealthy Western countries in the bloc, France, Germany, Spain, voting for the measure. So the idea of being able to get that 65% in terms of population is actually quite positive. Interestingly, 60% of all public investment in Poland and 55% in Hungary between 2015 and 2017 was EU cash. So there is significant pressure that could be put on these countries to actually abide by European values of democracy and liberalism, etc., etc., etc. So my question for you, John, is which should be valued higher? National sovereignty? Because Poland and Hungary, the governments that are in power, were democratically elected in at least reasonably fair elections. Just last month, for instance, Orban was elected on 50% of the vote. In a multi-party system like his, the next runner-up only won 20% of the vote. So he is a clear favourite among Hungarians that are voting in these elections. Nonetheless, which should be valued higher, national sovereignty or the idea of liberal democracy? Because Germany and France would be pushing for liberal democracy. The Western nations are holding to account these Eastern nations in the European Union. Should they be allowed to do it? Should they be allowed to use something like the European Union to withhold, to put the financial pressure on these countries to abide by a specific philosophy, a specific political philosophy? Because this is kind of akin to the free speech debate in a sense.
How so?
These countries are acting on a democratic right. They have elected the governments they have. And yet you're going to have larger countries in the European bloc come in and say, no, you need to abide by these values.
It's a tough question because I almost straddle the fence on something like this. I'm a big believer in national sovereignty, but I'm also a big believer in international law as well. And I don't want to say primacy of international law, but it annoys me to no end when the United States acts as a unilateral power in things like Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I think that, you know, you have these international systems that are supposed to keep other countries in check. I don't necessarily have an issue with the EU requiring certain things from their members for investment. I mean, if you're getting 60% of your public investment, or like 55 in Hungary's case, from the EU, I don't think it's unreasonable for the EU to require certain strictures on your government or what you're allowed to do. This is probably one of the same reasons why we're not going to see Turkey come into the EU fold. I know that there's been talk over the past decade or so that Turkey may eventually join the EU, but with what we've been talking about with Erdogan becoming more and more authoritarian, it seems less and less likely that he would be accepted into the EU fold. The EU definitely has a brand. The EU definitely has its founding principles. And if you want to be a member and benefit from that, then you probably should have to abide by the overall rules of that system. It's similar to something in the United States where many times federal funding is withheld from states that don't meet federal standards. So you see that in education, you see that in highway funding in particular. So when the federal drinking age in the United States was raised to 21, there was actually a rule put in place where if states could keep the current age that they had if they wanted to and not raise it to 21, but they would forfeit federal highway funding. And so you saw some states hold out, but eventually their infrastructure just needed that investment. So they raised the age to 21 to continue that investment from the federal government.
I'm glad you brought up the American case, because many people would point to these types of things and say that the U.S. federal government is overstepping its constitutional bounds by using the power of the purse to effectively force the states into a federal policy when it really should be state rights. So, for instance, education. You know, you withhold federal funding for education from a state because they don't meet your particular federal standard. What you're doing is you're imposing, perhaps not in a direct way, but you are imposing indirectly federal power in an institution that should be left to the power of the states. So you could make the same argument here, is that, you know, what is the function of the EU? Should it have the capacity to dictate political philosophy in these member states. So it's this type of thing, actually, that, you know, you imagine it's switched and actually the majority of the EU countries are, you know, authoritarian Eastern countries. You know, you could easily see why then the UK would want to get out of the EU. It's because the EU shouldn't be dictating to its member states particular political outcomes.
I'm not so sure about that, because if we look at the example of the United States, we wouldn't have had the strides in civil rights that we had if it weren't for the federal government imposing its will on the member states. There was a huge amount of backlash against the federal government for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then some Supreme Court cases that went through that, you know, ended segregation. So, you know, you had states that literally were not going to implement these laws, and you had the president of the United States saying, well, if need be, I will send in the National Guard to enforce these rules. So when it comes to certain things, I mean, there are some things I think that are probably negotiable that individual states can decide on. So income tax, for instance, internal budgets, even gun laws, things like that, those can be governed by the states, because I wouldn't say that those have a fundamental effect on human rights, right? They don't have a fundamental effect on the ideals on which the United States is founded, the ideals of the American Constitution. But when you're talking about not allowing people to vote because of their race, not allowing people to intermarry, allowing businesses to deny services to people because of their certain race, at that point, I don't have a problem with the federal government coming in and saying, well, you know, all this funding that you have for your education system and XYZ, I don't have a problem with them coming in and saying, we're not giving that to you anymore because these things that you're doing are unconstitutional. And I know it's a little bit different because the EU is not founded necessarily on a constitution.
And specifically, it's not a federation.
Yes, but if you're going to benefit from the EU, I mean, if you really look at it, it's a democratic system, right? The majority of the states that are involved in the EU have these expectations of members of the EU. And if you don't want to be in the union, if you don't want the financial benefit, or if keeping the rules that you have in your country is worth more to you than the financial benefit, then you can leave, just like the UK did.
But specifically because it's not a federation, could you imagine, well, in fact, you can easily imagine, and we already disagree with this, the idea of the states coming into another country to dictate political terms. That's effectively what's happening. You've got a Western pact within the EU going to the East and saying, no, you need to do things in this Western way or it's no go for you. Now, I agree with you, actually. I think what should happen is if Poland and Hungary can't live up to the expectations of the EU in terms of their values, they should leave. They should actually be kicked out. But I don't like this middle route in which, you know, the West is effectively dictating to the East what has to be done. Largely because you are creating that divide. You've got a set of, you know, relatively poor countries in the East whose largely their own democratic choices are being undermined. They are being dictated to by the Franco-German side of the European Union. I think either they have to come into line of their own volition or they have to leave. This kind of middle way of dictating what has to happen to get money, I don't quite like. It's almost like trying to save the union via the weakest option of just kind of sappy, soft financial mechanics.
I don't know if it's the softest option, though. I mean, how is this any different than sanctions?
I think the softest aspect of it is actually the history looking back is that the European Union has never used financial powers against any of its members. So, in effect, it could just simply be a warning shot to Poland and Hungary. But it's not sanctions per se, because you can't, and the European Union can't legally do this. They can't stop trade, for instance. They can't impose duties. They can't impose tariffs. Typical or stereotypical sanctions don't apply or can't be applied within the European Union.
Do you think that this is the EU trying to consolidate power after Brexit?
In a sense, yeah. And if you read through the budget, you kind of get that sense in which they're trying to increase their overall investment in the regions. They're trying to implement some tax structures that just haven't existed before. You could kind of see it as a little bit of a power grab, as an expansion of EU governance. So yeah, I would say that. And then in addition, you've got this measure on the side that's also calling countries into line. And again, I don't like where Hungary and Poland are going. I disagree with it. But I don't think it's necessarily within the EU's interest to be pursuing a path like this. One of the biggest problems I have with the EU is that it is kind of soft, almost as if it's you know, it doesn't have balls in a sense to actually do what it needs to do. You chuck the countries out that you disagree with, or you keep them in, you suck it up, and you build bridges in other ways. This kind of middle ground, I think, is going to be... I don't think it's going to do anything, actually.
Well, I mean, Hungary and Poland stand to lose quite a bit here. I think that financial incentives are sometimes stronger than even diplomatic ones. I mean, we'll get into this a little bit later, because I honestly think that one of the things that influenced North Korea into its stance right now is the financial sanctions that are going on against it and the pressure that it's feeling from the international community. So I don't necessarily view financial sanctions, which I think this would essentially boil down to, I don't view that as an inherently bad thing, especially since, you know, the EU has a certain expectation of its member states. It won't allow in authoritarian nations like Turkey. So why would it tolerate authoritarian nations that, or nations that are already in the fold of the EU, becoming more authoritarian? I guess I just don't necessarily have a problem with that. Because when you do sign on to the EU, you do forfeit some of your national sovereignty. And I think that comes with the territory. It's an understanding that you are forfeiting some of your national sovereignty. And then you can't complain about it when you fall out of the ideological framework of the EU. And then them say, well, we really don't want to be subsidizing your, you know, more than half of your public investment if you're not going to toe the line when it comes to democratic freedoms. I guess that's the way I look at it. If this was a standalone country that wasn't in the EU and it was other nations trying to force themselves onto the other country and force political change within that nation, I might have more of an issue with it. But these countries willingly signed on to the EU. It's not as though they're forced to be there.
Part of the nuance that this story is missing, though, is the lives of the everyday people, the Hungarians, the Polish, that are still actually living in Poland, because what these sanctions will do is impact farm subsidies and infrastructure projects. It would affect many run-of-the-mill, average, everyday European citizens. A significant number wouldn't have voted for the currently governing parties. And so what the European Union also has to do is to make sure that it doesn't alienate those people. That's the risk that the European Union is running, that by levying these sanctions against these countries, that you're actually going to turn moderate, relatively pro-Europeans against the European Union, just isolating the country further. I don't see how it produces a way for Hungary or Poland to return to the fold. It doesn't seem as if there's an easy way to do that other than to sulk back, asking for alms and forgiveness. So we know another really important event happened this week, an almost surreal event happening in the Koreas. John, I know that you want to catch us up on that.
Well, I think people are probably caught up on this. It's been covered pretty extensively. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I do want to just go over the event and then talk about the ramifications that we could see and the long-term political play by the South Korean president Moon Jae-in that I think is developing here. And also I want to take a look at maybe some of the motivations behind Kim and the United States in these talks, because I think that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
All right, what do you have for us?
So as everyone knows, the meeting happened on Friday, April 27th. It was historic. Kim Jong-un became the first leader of North Korea to actually step foot in South Korea. There's a video of him walking or waddling up to the line in the demilitarized zone and stepping over after a brief handshake with the South Korean President Moon Jae-in. And then actually, Kim invites Moon over onto the northern side, and they both go on for a photo op there. I thought it was quite surreal seeing the two together, because you normally see Kim in a much more imposing way. Most of the time that you see him, he has his aura of the dictator. He's wearing his dictator hat. And on that day, he was wearing his diplomat hat. And it was a role I don't think that we've ever seen him play before. It's very interesting.
It was weird to see him in that position because he looked normal. Like, he looked presidential. Like, he sauntered in, he looked happy, he looked charismatic, he looked confident. He was, like you said, he was the one that suggested that they step over the line again into North Korea. It was, you know, I don't know if that itself was a power play. You're right. It was an odd, strange thing to see, in which everything looked normal in such an abnormal situation.
I know. As I was watching it, I almost had to pinch myself to remind myself that he's a brutal dictator. I mean, you're talking about North Korea that has literal prison camps There's something called the three generations rule, which is if you are a dissident, then not only you, but your parents and your children go to this prison camp with you. People who defect and try to leave are tortured and murdered. He murders and tortures family members for falling asleep at cabinet meetings. To see him with a smile on his face talking to another world leader as if, you know, nothing was happening, it was weird. I had to remind myself of who he really is.
But strikingly, you know, even though he has this image, and especially considering the image that he portrays at home as kind of this divine dictator, he was quite candid, actually, about the failings of his country and his regime. So he pointed to the infrastructure. He said that he would be embarrassed to invite the South Korean president to the north of the country because the infrastructure was terrible. Like, that's an unusual thing for a North Korean dictator to say, because generally they don't admit anything other than perfection. So it's completely new face of Kim.
I was shocked at that, actually, because the nature of the propaganda machine in North Korea is really quite remarkable. They literally treat the Kims like they are infallible human beings, or not, like, almost on a level higher than human beings. And for him to admit that there are flaws, I wonder how much of that was portrayed to the North Korean people, or if it was heavily edited so that that wasn't said or they didn't hear that. Because it seems to directly contradict the kind of image that he tries to portray to his own people.
And you do also wonder how much of the image was created specifically for this event as well, or perhaps even for the long term.
Agreed. I do think that if they can stick to the terms of the deal and actually follow through on their talks, this is absolutely historic. They talked about denuclearizing the entire peninsula. They talked about ending the Korean War. In fact, they declared the Korean War over. And there was talk even of South Korea investing in infrastructure in North Korea. It's the framework or foundation of a completely new relationship between the two countries. Kim obviously has his demands. He has stated that he would be willing to give up his nuclear weapons. What he precisely means by that, I don't know. Does he mean give up all of his weapons? Does he mean giving up future nuclear weapons? Does he mean giving up testing? We know that he has said that he's giving up testing and that he will be closing testing sites. He even said he was willing to allow investigators to come into North Korea to watch the dismantling of the nuclear test sites. But how far does that go? Is he actually going to give up all his weapons? Is he going to allow the United States military to come in and confiscate his nuclear weapons? I don't know. But what he did say is his condition for whatever he means by denuclearization is that the United States promises not to invade. To which I say, what in the world did Mike Pompeo say to him in his meeting a few weeks ago? Because after that, really what you're seeing is a complete softening of Kim's position here. And almost an entire 180 from what we saw before.
Sorry, so you think that Pompeo went in with a list of threats that essentially forced Kim to 180?
It could be. There was some talk back in, I think, July 4th of last year where Kim was present at a nuclear testing site and the United States came out and said that we actually had our snipers had him in range during that testing site.
Yeah, I remember that.
I don't know. Maybe he brought that up. Maybe he brought up that there are plans to invade, especially with John Bolton as the national security advisor. That's not something that's out of the realm of possibility. For quite some time, international intelligence agencies have known that there's been communication, at the very least, between Iran and North Korea on their nuclear program. We know that North Korea has sold ballistic missiles to Iran. There are rumors that there were Iranian scientists present at some nuclear testings. So we don't know the extent of that relationship, but I'm wondering whether or not Pompeo and the United States are angling for information on Iran's nuclear program, especially coming into the decision whether or not we're going to recertify the deal. Because Iran and North Korea do have a working relationship when it comes to these sorts of things. So Pompeo could have even mentioned something about Iran. And who knows, perhaps Kim is trying to help with the Iran nuclear deal. Because if you really think about it, what message would that send to North Korea as to our reliability when we're making nuclear weapons treaties if we pull out of the Iran deal right before we start negotiating with North Korea? So is Kim perhaps playing this so that the United States doesn't pull out of the Iran deal prematurely and put the sanctions back on Iran? Or did Pompeo say something about, hey, we won't invade you and we won't topple your government, which we're totally capable of, if you come to the table and give us everything you know about the Iranian nuclear program? It just seems too convenient for Pompeo to have met with him a couple weeks ago and for this to have happened. I don't think Kim came to the table on his own terms here. I mean, he was definitely jolly and happy and he seemed glad to be there, but I don't ever think that he would have come to the table like this on his own terms without having some sort of stick that's motivating him to do so. Because not only is the United States waffling on the Iran nuclear deal, but Kim has to understand, and Trump even actually brought attention to this. He actually said the framework he'd like to use for Kim's denuclearization was what Gaddafi did in 2003. Hmm. And to expect Kim to draw the lesson from that, that the United States won't invade and topple you if you get rid of your nukes, is naive. There's no way that he looks at that in any other way than the United States will topple you once you become a non-nuclear threat.
Well, that's what I was going to suggest to you. You've said already on this podcast that looking at Libya, why would Kim ever trust the United States? Like, how do you reconcile that? So you essentially think that there has been some arm twisting that even at the threat of a Libya-like situation coming, that Kim still had to come to the table?
There's really got to be, I think. Pompeo, when he actually became Secretary of State, in his speech, he said that he wanted to bring swagger back to U.S. foreign policy. No, really. And I think that's what he's trying to do here. He's trying to be the big kid on the block. He's trying to push people around with sheer influence based on the military might of the United States.
I mean, isn't it working, in a sense?
It is. It is working. And so it's frustrating to me because Pompeo, like I've mentioned on this podcast before, I'm not a huge fan of him. I think he's a warmonger. But in this case, I have to credit him in some big way with Kim coming to the table here.
And of course, credit should also go to Trump, should it not? Nobel Peace Prize nominee?
Well, according to Moon Jae-in, he is the president of South Korea. There's apparently he received a phone call and somebody said that Moon Jae-in ought to receive a Nobel Peace Prize. And he said, no, that should go to Trump for what he's done.
I love it. I love it. I called this a year and a half ago.
You're Nostradamus, seriously. But honestly, I think Moon Jae-in, that was a brilliant political move on his part.
Mm.
Because what we know of Trump is that he has a rather large ego. And the concept of being worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize and being told that he's worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize by another leader of a nation, he's going to go into this, and for the sake of his own ego, he doesn't want to screw this up. So it's going to give him more motivation to actually not scuttle these talks and not escalate with Kim on Twitter. And you've even seen Trump said something about how Kim was acting in an honorable way. So Trump is obviously softened towards Kim just because of this whole process. And I think that the rhetoric coming out of South Korea has helped with that. The rhetoric saying that Trump has really masterminded this whole thing and he's worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize because of this. So I think that the long-term play politically here by South Korea is get on Trump's good side, flatter him, and he won't screw this up, for lack of a better, you know, phrase. And also, I think Kim has been sort of forced to the table here because whatever Mike Pompeo said to him in that meeting must have been dire for him to have switched so suddenly, to literally go from firing missiles over Japan to offering full denuclearization for a promise not to invade. I mean, how else can you explain that? It's not the whims of a dictator. Kim is a rational actor. He's not going to do anything that's going to put him at risk of being ousted.
If I could add my own interpretation to the situation, you'd mentioned Chinese sanctions of North Korea in the last story. I do wonder how much, or even if it's possible, that North Korea has kind of seen the light in a sense, and that while, you know, there have been cases like Libya in which military might just has overthrown regimes, that, you know, a sense of honorable diplomacy actually gets you further than threatening your neighbors with military strikes. Because that can work for the states. The states has the manpower to say, you know what, we're going to bomb, you know, chemical storages in Syria, and it happens the next week. Korea, North Korea, can't necessarily stand up to the claims that it makes. So I'm wondering how much of a dose of reality Kim has had, and perhaps that's motivated him to switch tracks. What do you think?
There's really a couple of ways that this could end. Either Kim denuclearizes, we hold up our promise to not invade, we recertify the nuclear deal with Iran, and we have a nuclear-free Iran and North Korea. Or, honestly, it could end with us invading Korea on some pretense in the next few years because he's denuclearized. With the United States' track record on foreign policy, there's really no way of knowing until it actually happens.
Although, you know, again, if you were to strictly compare to Libya, the Libya situation doesn't have a South Korea. In other words, a very close ally of the United States, literally on the border, who shares a cultural and historical connection with the North. I mean, they are the same people. The Koreans are Koreans, no matter whether they're North or South. That didn't exist in the Libya case. And so, you know, South Korea, I think, ultimately has the power to sway the American leadership. And I think it's, you're right, in a sense, it's more easy to sway Trump through his ego than other presidents in the past. But South Korea ultimately has this final say, I think.
So what's your thought on it? Do you think that this is it? The Korean crisis is over and Trump has ended it?
I think I always fall back on a cynical perspective. I think we need more data, essentially. We don't know who the new Kim is. We don't know what his new goals are. You know, for all we know, this could be, you know, not this Olympics. I think two Olympics previous, North Korea used, you know, the joint South Korea-North Korea team to build kind of a cultural connection with the South and to put on a good face. And it ended up being, you know, just a mask for what ended up becoming, you know, more nuclear testing, more ballistics missile testing that occurred afterwards. And then, of course, you had the rocket tests late last year over Japan and in the Koreas. So is this a really big mask for a really big problem, or is Kim, you know, has the sanctions, the economic sanctions from Korea, the fact that one of their nuclear sites has essentially self-destructed, the ongoing economic problems that exist in North Korea, has that finally brought the regime to a point of saying, well, you know, can it be any worse than just going to the South Koreans and the Americans and saying, well, let's see where this goes, this whole diplomacy and peace thing?
The Irish border has become a point of contention between the UK and the EU. Now, this border may play an important role in the upcoming Brexit negotiations. Adam reports on the complexities of the situation.
I have a Schrodinger's cat-type problem for you. Schrodinger's cat is a thought experiment highlighting the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which essentially states that an object in a physical system exists simultaneously in all of its possible states. But when the system is observed, the physical object is forced into one of those possible states. Enter an unwitting cat. Placed in a box with a bottle of poison, a hammer, a Geiger counter, and some radioactive material. Over the course of an hour, the radioactive material has a 50% chance of releasing a single atom as it decays. When the Geiger counter detects the atom, the hammer falls, breaking the bottle of poison, killing the cat. When the box is closed, the atom in question is simultaneously in a decayed and non-decayed state. Therefore, the condition of the cat is unknown until the observer opens the box to observe the system. Snowball logically then exists in a superposition, being both simultaneously dead and alive. This is a paradox. Two contradictory outcomes existing simultaneously. Here then is your Schrodinger's cat problem for today, or rather Schrodinger's border problem. The Irish-British border, which separates Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, is Schrodinger's border. It paradoxically exists in two states at once. Thanks to the Belfast Agreement, which ended hostilities known as the Troubles between Protestant Loyalists and Catholic Republicans in the North, the border that separates the UK and Ireland both simultaneously exists and doesn't exist. On one hand, it does separate very real legal jurisdiction. So on one side of the border, you're subject to British common law, while on the other side of the border, you're subject to the Irish Constitution. But on the other hand, everyone born in the North has the right to Irish citizenship as if they were born in the Republic. There's free trade, there's no passport checks. In fact, other than a change in currency and road markers, and those of Irish Gaelic on road signs, it's difficult to tell when the international boundary has actually been crossed. The open border was designed to make it feel like Northern Ireland itself was two countries at once. Those who wanted to be Irish could be Irish and live in, well, Ireland, quote unquote. While those who wanted to be British could be British living in Britain. But as with many things nowadays, feelings and perceptions trump reality. The trick is not to look too hard at it. If we don't pay attention to the border, it can exist in a state of superposition as both being there and not there. Ah, no problems. Ah, right, who looked? On June 23rd, 2016, 52% of voters in the United Kingdom voted to withdraw the country from the European Union. 9 months later, the UK government invoked Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, kicking off a 2-year countdown to Brexit. The UK will leave the European Union at 11 p.m, randomly, British time, on the 29th of March 2019. Since the triggering of Article 50, the UK and the EU have been negotiating the terms under which the UK leaves the EU. Most of this has now been agreed to. Well, no, restatement for clarity. The UK has agreed to the EU's terms on most of these issues. One issue that hasn't yet been agreed to is the function of the Irish-British border. Effectively, it will become a border of the European Union. Now, there are two basic outcomes, two possible states, if you will. The first is a hard border, in which customs checks, tariffs, fees, and possibly passport checks all return to the currently open border. History does not shine a positive light on Irish border zones, which were once marked by barbed wire, soldiers, terrorism, intimidating checks, smuggling. These were all part of the Troubles. The desire to return to a hard border does not sit easily in the minds of the Irish. The second option, then, is far more difficult to accomplish. It's a continuation of the soft border. The UK and the EU are agreed on their desire to maintain a soft border, but they've been in an impasse for months as to the solution. Talks have been ongoing, with each side poo-pooing the other's suggestions. Initially, an early agreement was reached when it was announced that Northern Ireland, for the time being, could remain inside the customs union. That's the free trade part of the EU. This would conceivably have placed a customs border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. The idea was quickly scuppered when the DUP, that's the Northern Irish Unionist Party and a supporter of the UK government, protested the agreement, halting talks. Likewise, though, the UK had proposed its own remedy, which was instantly rejected by the EU. Known as the Highly Streamlined Customs Arrangement, it involved using technological solutions to lower customs barriers in line with what's occurring along the lengthy Swedish-Norwegian border. Norway, not part of the EU, runs an advanced system of pre-travel clearances on goods and performs routine random checks on goods entering the country by road. The problem for the UK is that while it's pointed to a successful system working on another border in another part of Europe, it's provided few details other than they do it, we'll do it too. It was rejected as a mere list of best practices which should be applicable to any customs arrangement anywhere. The EU has thrown its full weight behind the Irish case for the retention of the soft border, and in doing so has reminded the UK that the Irish border problem is not only about tariffs and collecting duty. It's about the people and the cultures in the area as well. The final proposal on the table is, ironically, a customs partnership. The proposed system would allow the UK to run its own system of tariffs while collecting duties on behalf of the EU for goods entering the UK bound for the EU. This has not yet been rejected by the EU, but there does seem to be some pushback. On the positive side, a change in border arrangements would be virtually unnoticeable to those who actually live in border towns and possibly even for those who commute across the border. On the downside, the UK is again scant on the details. What role would Irish customs play? What new burdens would they have? How does the UK apply EU customs laws when they're not even in the EU? How do you track goods headed for the EU versus those that will stay in the UK? The UK government's inability to say is all part and parcel of a larger problem. The British government is and always has been in a weak position. The EU economy can afford to lose the entire British economy and still be larger than China, whereas the UK will be pulling itself out of the most lucrative free trade agreement in the world while trying to minimise the inevitable economic damage, and that statement is according to the government's own research, it's not my own. The EU has, therefore, been in the driving seat in negotiations since day one, setting the schedule of negotiations and the amount to be paid by the UK for the privilege of withdrawing, which is in the realm of about £40 to £50 billion. Added to this is the UK government's weakness in Parliament. In June of last year, Theresa May lost a majority on a bungled gamble and is now supported by the DUP, the Northern Irish Loyalists and Pro-Brexit Party. Any move either to separate Northern Ireland from the UK by any measure or to move towards a softer Brexit could lead the DUP withdrawing their support and collapsing the government. Simultaneously, the Conservative Party itself is split between hard Brexit and soft Brexit. May's government balances on the head of a pin to stop one side or the other rebelling against her and collapsing her government. So fragile is its position that even as I'm sitting here recording this on Wednesday night, the British cabinet, looks as if it's more or less rejected the customs partnership that we just talked about. And the government is doubling down on a highly streamlined customs arrangement which the EU has already rejected. The government, of course, says all options remain on the table. Heaven help us. Across the Irish Sea, the Irish Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, has demanded a resolution to the Irish border question by the next meeting of the European Council. That's the heads of government of all 28 member states of the EU. The UK, meanwhile, maintains that October is a more realistic date. The October meeting of the European Council is significant as it's the deadline for the completed withdrawal agreement. The intervening 5 months in the lead-up to the March withdrawal deadline is necessary to allow the parliaments of all the EU member states, as well as the European Parliament itself, to approve of the withdrawal agreement. Leaving the border question open to that last minute is a risky strategy. There are two saving graces for this situation. One, these are only the starting points for negotiation, and ultimately the government could swing all the way back to keeping Northern Ireland in the customs union for the sake of a good withdrawal deal. And two, the unelected House of Lords, that bastion of equality, democracy and youthful vigour, has successfully amended the withdrawal bill to include a government commitment to protecting all aspects of the Belfast Agreement, in essence putting into the agreement itself the protection of the status quo of the Irish-British border. The House of Commons can of course overturn the amendment, but that may be difficult given the limited government support in the House and the political optics of the government voting against its own policy. After all, the government's position is to protect the status quo of the Irish border. The solution I like best has been suggested by a contributor to the Slugger O'Toole blog, a great resource on Northern Irish politics if you're interested. Let Northern Ireland decide. Throw another referendum at the problem. Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU 56% to 44%. If they want to be in the EU and in the UK, and they have the option of doing it, let them have their cake and eat it too. The devolved government of Northern Ireland, which has representatives even from the DUP, has been consistently lobbying the UK government for a special status for Northern Ireland. So let them have it. Referenda are a good way anyway of breaking the power of the large sectarian parties, the DUP and Sinn Féin, which monopolise power in the devolved government. By letting people choose what's best for them individually, the large parties then become subject to the will of the people of Northern Ireland as a whole, and not just to their communities. Schrödinger published his thought experiment not to explain quantum mechanics, but to critique the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. That a cat could both be alive and dead simultaneously was ridiculous, ludicrous. The interpretation had to be flawed. But an international border and a superposition of existence and non-existence is possible, it's real. You can visit it and see its effects, or lack thereof. But now we've looked too hard at it. We've observed it. The superposition will collapse into one single state. The problem is, we still don't know which one.
Finally today, we take a look at some developing stories that you should pay attention to this week.
As I alluded to in my report on the Irish border, the UK government still has to figure out what it's doing with the future customs arrangement with the EU and what it'll look like. The cabinet meeting held on Wednesday yielded a split in the government. Theresa May has generally been adept at reaching compromise agreements between hard Brexiteers and soft Brexiteers in our cabinet and in our party. But the customs conundrum is more of a binary situation. You're either in a customs union or you're out. According to Politico, May has 1 week to reach a compromise. With the threat of rebellions on both sides of the Brexit coin, the May government may not be long for this world.
Coming back to the US, For anybody who's interested in the Russia investigation, Trump hired Emmett Flood, who was the Clinton impeachment attorney. This could mean that he expects more heat from the Mueller investigation. Mueller has recently come out and said that there could potentially be a subpoena for President Trump if he refuses to cooperate with the investigation and submit himself for an interview. Trump is surrounding himself with high-power attorneys in the situation, which seems to indicate that he's ready for a long-term legal battle. This story really has been developing since the 2016 election, but it really feels like things are coming to a head and that's something to watch out for.
Moving back to the European side of the Atlantic and maybe a little bit further out towards the end of the Mediterranean, on Monday this week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed that his government had come into possession of intelligence that proved Iran had been backsliding in its nuclear commitments as part of the Iranian nuclear deal. In an odd presentation, and I mean really odd, it's kind of a strange mix between a university lecture and an amateur stage production, Netanyahu said that the Israeli government had 55,000 pages of evidence and a further 55,000 files on 183 CDs that showed that Iran had the explicit goal of producing five warheads with a capacity of 10 kilotons of TNT. Now, President Trump, who as part of his campaign platform promised to undo the Iran nuclear deal, he has an opportunity to do that very thing this week, on May 12th, when he will be asked to authorize the deal for a further 3 months. That is something to look out for.
And finally, from the US this week, Trump's nominee for CIA Director Gina Haspel will be heading to Capitol Hill next week to start her hearings in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, this is another controversial pick. I know I sound like a broken record, but it's really true this time. Haspel was a director of a CIA black site in Thailand where she was actually involved in the torture of an inmate. She was also involved in the destruction of videotapes depicting torture during the congressional investigation on the CIA torture program. Her margin for error looks even tighter than Mike Pompeo's last week. No Democrats on the committee have said that they will support her, although Rand Paul said that he is opposed to her nomination and plans to vote against her. Does that sound familiar? If Rand Paul does indeed oppose her and votes that way, it's unlikely that she'll get through the committee to the Senate floor. However, with Rand Paul flipping his vote on Mike Pompeo, we really don't know what to expect. If things hold that way, they'll need to flip a Democrat on the committee, but no one yet has said that they would be willing to vote for her. Well, that's it for today's episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We are also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all our episodes to this website and also host forums for discussion so that you as the audience can engage with our content. Thank you for listening, and as always, stay weird.